Good morning, everyone. Today's daf and ksivus is Chaf Zayin. We begin today on the bottom of Chaf Vav Aminav. We're at the two dots. We're starting with the words Rav Yehuda Omer. We thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship. Daf Zlon Zecher Nishmas Liba Gabriela Bashmuel. Back to the Mishnah. A topic that the Gemara has now been covering and working on now for the last couple of days, and we're going to be doing another day of this topic. And that is Yichus Lagabe a Kohen. How do we know that a Kohen is Miyuchas? So the Mishnah goes all the way back to Chav Gimel Amud Beis. And the Mishnah is really just a continuation of the previous Mishnayos where there is self-reporting that's done. So generally speaking, halacha self-reporting is does not have halachic significance. One cannot have a status based on a self-report that's given. If he doesn't have a chazakah, if he doesn't have a presumption of being a particular person, in other words, we don't know he's a Kohen, we don't know he's a Levi, and he walks into town, what can create that presumption? So the best answer, of course, is Eidah. So you have testimony that two people say about him that he's in fact a Kohen, he's in fact a Levi, so that creates a presumption. But what if we don't have Eidah? So we've been spending a couple of days discussing if anything could be a replacement for Eidah. Let's say, for example, you see him duchening, or he gets the first aliyah, or you see him getting a distribution of truma. So there are telltale signs that he's a Kohen, but is that enough? In other words, can that create a status change? So that has been the discussion of the past couple of days. The discussion has been complicated by the fact that even when we see him doing these things, it could be that he's given limited status but not full status. What I mean by that is that maybe can he truma, but we're not gonna give him full yichus, and we won't assume that the daughters can marry him, and so it is a complex issue that we've been covering. Let's go back to the Mishnah. Let's try to keep it as simple as possible. And if you turn back to the Mishnah, so the Mishnah brought down a machlokes. So I'm just going to review the Mishnah all the way back on Chav Gimel Amud Beis, so that we can set ourselves up for the Gemara's question. So the Mishnah says that if each of the Kohanim go back and they say I'm a Kohen, so they're not believed, because as we discussed in the introduction, a self-report does not have significance. But if they report about each other, they're Neman. And you remember the Gemara had a discussion at the beginning about whether or not we should be worried about collusion, and that itself was up for debate, but clearly the author of the Tanakhama of this Mishnah is not worried about collusion. Rabbi Huda is of the opinion that one witness is not sufficient. Rabbi Huda says you need two witnesses in order to establish somebody's status as being a Kohen. Rabbi Lazar says two witnesses are necessary, but only if you have people who are protesting. But if there's nobody that's protesting, so then one witness would be sufficient. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Mishum Rabbi Shimon Ben Azgan, and then finally the Mishnah records another opinion. And what's this last opinion of the Mishnah? Said in the name of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, said in the name of Rabbi Shimon Ben Azgan, Malakun Napiyed Achad, that one witness is sufficient. Okay, now that I went through the Mishnah, the question is obvious. Meaning we have the final opinion in the Mishnah, but that final opinion in the Mishnah has already been espoused once earlier in the Mishnah. Meaning, Rabbi Lazar is of the opinion that if there are Orerin, so then you need two witnesses. But if there are no Orerin, if no one's contesting, so then one witness is sufficient. So the Gemara asked the question. Now we turn all the way to where we are. And Chavav Amar Aleph, Rabbi Yehuda Amarin Malan Lekun Apirecha V'chule, Rabbi Shimon Gamal, and Rabbi Lazar. So Rabbi Shimon Gamal and Rabbi Lazar are stating one in the same position, which is that one witness should be sufficient. So the Gemara says, okay, there must be some sort of nuanced difference between Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and so the Gemara here attempts to give a nuanced difference. So maybe there is a protest, meaning one witness stepped forward and one witness said he's a Kohen. And these two Tanaim are of the opinion that one witness is sufficient. And maybe the issue now is that what if, let's say, I don't have two people contesting, but let's say I have one person contesting. And maybe the point of dispute between Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Lazar is what is considered a halachically significant contestation. Meaning, what does it take in order to say that the one witness doesn't know what he's talking about? Does it take one against one, or does it take two against one? So the Gemara says, first of all, that's a very difficult way to explain the machlokas. The Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Devar HaKola, in Ir Er Pachos Mishtaim. So first of all, the Gemara says, we have a statement by Rabbi Yochanan, and it seems to be that it's just an accepted statement. Nobody argues with that. And that is, Everyone's in agreement that protesting can only be done by two. Meaning a challenge to somebody's status can only be created by two. And if you just have one person challenging the status, that's not considered a challenge. And if that's so, so then the Gemara says, Ir'ur by definition means that two people are challenging. Okay. Ela hachem b'maiskinan. So the Gemara says as follows. Fine. That's not the difference between Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Lazar. So what is the difference? So the Gemara says, it goes like this. So we start off with the following. We know that the father is a Kohen. Chazaka, meaning that's an established fact. It's a presumption, it's an assumption. We know the father is a Kohen. And then, so then what happens is, reports come back that although dad's a Kohen, but dad unfortunately did not choose well in terms of who he married. Dad married either a Grusha or a Chalutza. And what does that make the child? That makes the child a Chalo. The child has no Kedushas Kahuna. Dad is a Kohen, but he's not a Kohen with any of the rights and privileges of being a Kohen. Good. So then, V'achtinu. So what do? We bring him down. Meaning, we remove the status because reports are that mom and dad are... I'm sorry. Right. Dad is a Kohen. He married an Isser, so this child is a Chalah. One witness comes along, and one witness says... that no, what do? That's not true. Meaning, what you heard, the reports that you heard are just simply not true. The dad is a Kohen, and that's an established fact, and dad did not marry a Grusha, dad did not marry a Chalutza, and therefore the child is okay. And again, that's one witness, and again, according to Rav Shimon Gamliel and according to Rabbi Lazar, one witness is sufficient in order to bring somebody's status back up. V'askinu. So then what do? We brought him up. The basin brought him up to the status of being a Kohen. And then the story continues. This is a real drama. And then two witnesses come along, and two witnesses said, no. Contrary to the one witness said, the one witness who defended him, two come along and two say, it's not true. The rumors were true. Mom was a Grusha, mom was a Chalutza, and therefore the child is a Chalal. And therefore what we do is we brought him down. The Asa basin brought him down. So again, so I know this is it's a complex scenario, and there's a lot of chapters in the story. But basically, rumors again, dad's a Kohen, that's a fact. Therefore the son should be assumed to be a Kohen, but rumors were circulating that mom was a Grusha. And so therefore the child does not have Kedushas Kuna. One defended his status, and again, these two tonight, Rav Shimon Gamliel and Rav Lazar says, a defense of the status is considered a good defense, even if it was only defended by one witness, and therefore he's a Kohen. Then what happened was two said, it's not true. And they were ma'arer. They challenged the one witness, and two challenging is in fact a challenge, and they brought him back down again. And here we go. The Asayid Echad, where the last chapter of the story. The Asayid Echad, Vamar Yadana Beit Kohenu, I'm sorry, Yadana Beit Kohenu. And another witness comes in and says, the two who are challenging are incorrect. We know that he, in fact, is a Kohen. We know, in fact, that mom is not a Grusha, not a Chalutza. So let's put everything now together. Let's take a look at the whole story. And what do we have? Let's take the rumors and put the rumors on the back. Meaning the rumors right now are... not going to be the key. The key is going to be now, you have how many sets of witnesses? You have two sets of witnesses. One set of witnesses saying that mom was a Grusha, and another set of witnesses who say that mom was not a Grusha. Okay. Now, the two sets of witnesses who said that mom is not a Grusha, they didn't come at the same time. One came before the two challengers, one came after the two challengers. Now, in terms of witnesses, can you put the two of them together? So this is a topic known as Hitstarfus. Whether or not we could take two testimonies that were stated independent of one another and put the two together. The Gemara says, "Udikule alma mitstarfin la'edus." Everyone's of the opinion that you can combine, that you can take these two testimonies that were said and put them together. So now, what's the problem? Meaning, so what do we have? Two witnesses say that he's no good. Two witnesses say that he is good. The chazaka says he is good. So I have a chazaka and I have two witnesses. Or if you would like to do the math this way, the two sets of witnesses cancel each other out. If they cancel each other out, we're back to the chazaka. What's the chazaka tell us? Dad's a Kohen. He's a Kohen. Okay. So, and the Gemara says over here, what's that issue? Is that in this scenario, are we worried about, look at Basin right now. Look at Basin flip-flopping. Basin first says that he's a good Kohen, then Basin says he's not a good Kohen, then Basin goes back to saying he's a good Kohen, then Basin says now he's not a good Kohen. I added one extra step, okay, and maybe for the purposes of drama. But in other words, but the point is that Basin keeps flip-flopping. So maybe we're worried about the appearance that Basin is going to be perceived as it goes back and forth in its give and take. And Rashi says over here, Chayshin Lezulus of the Beidina, Rashi says, Sharidu Shnei Pa'amim, V'achshav Ya'aluhu, twice Beis Din gave him a demotion. And now they're giving him a promotion. V'yavadlu divrayim v'haynu d'amar v'lazar d'me'achar sharidun al-pi ha'orerim ein ma'alin al-pi eidzeh ha'sheni alfa p'sheyesh l'tzarfo me'achan. And so what Rav Elazar says is, look, you have two challengers. The two challengers went against the one witness. Beis Din demoted him. That's it. Meaning, we're not going to go any further than that. Because if we continue along this course of demotion, promotion, Beis Din's going to look bad. And it's interesting, meaning, let's just make the obvious point over here. Meaning the appearance of Beis Din, the perception of Beis Din is, I don't want to say too simply, but in this particular case, more important than the status of this one particular Kohen. And, I mean, again, it comes out a little bit strange, but just saying it out loud. Under this conditions, yes, that's correct. Meaning, in terms of this status, so we don't know, and we keep flip-flopping based on the new information that's given. But for Beis Din to be, an institution that is revered, that is respected, so sometimes they realize we have to stop changing sides on this, and we have to come up with one approach or maybe two different approaches. But that's about it. Okay. I'm sorry, let me read this inside the Gemara. V'hacha b'mechash lezulus d'beidina k'bif l'gei, tanakam asavar kem d'achtinu lo maskin alei, chayshin lezulus d'beidina, that's the opinion of Rabbi Lazar, and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel savar. I know the Gemara says tanakama, but tanakama means relative to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Rabbi Lazar is of the opinion that the Beis Din is not going to go do all this flip-flopping. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel savar, ana nachtin alei v'ana maskin alei, lezulus d'beidina lo chayshinan. And Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, no, we're not worried about the impression of Beis Din. Okay, Beis Din's going to go back and forth on this issue. Beis Din will bring him down, Beis Din will bring him back up again, etc., etc., but we're not worried about the appearances. So, Maskav Rav Ashi Achi Afilu Shevashay Nami. So, Rav Ashi says, so I don't understand. So, if you're worried about the appearance of Beis Din, so why do you have to construct such a complicated case of two say this, one then said, I'm sorry, one said this, two then said that, one said this, meaning why not just deal with a much simpler case of two against two? And why not just simply contend that if it's two against two, and again, they're coming in at different times, so Beis Din doesn't, again, it's the same machlokas. But the same machlokas can be presented in a quote-unquote easier scenario. Two say he's no good, two say he's good, Beis Din puts him down, Beis Din puts him back up again. Just say the machlokas there. So Rav Ashi says, no. The reason why the case in our Mishnah is where it's one witness, then two, then one witness, is because that's exactly what's at issue over here. Can I take the one and put them together with the one? In other words, what the Gemara assumed just a moment ago, that everyone agrees it could be Mitzaref, now the Gemara is saying, no, that's exactly the point of Machlokas over here. Leidus Kamiflegi, Vapluta Dani tonight, the Tanya will learn to the Bryce, saying, Eidusa Mitzarefus Hachiru Shneim Ke'echad. Gemara over here quotes, it's in Sanhedrin. It's a very basic issue. Look, like we've said time and again, in order to establish any fact, you need two witnesses. Do those two witnesses have to come in at the same time? Do they have to testify at the same time? Now, mind you, by the way, when I say testify at the same time, that doesn't mean that they're going to be standing in the same room together and they're going to be testifying together. Because one of the maneuvers of Beis Din, in order to make sure that each one is giving verifiable information, is that they'll take the two stories and they'll take them separately from one another. They'll compare the two together, right? Gemara Sanhedrin, right? We've gone through this before, and God willing, we'll go through it again. But so it doesn't mean exactly at the same time, but it means that when Beis Din is adjudicating, they're there in the court at the same time. Each one will be taken into a room separately, but they're there together. So, so the Tanakama of this Braisa says that's exactly what you need. You need the two of them to be there in the basin at the same time. Rav Yeshua ben Karchomer, Afilu b'zachar zeh. even if they go one after the other. So the Tanakhama says that they have to actually be testifying together. And Rabbi Nassan says, and Rabbi Nassan says, no, that's not necessary. You can hear one report today, you can hear another report tomorrow, and that's going to be good. And the Gemara says that machlok is between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Nassan in terms of whether or not a testimony is admissible, even though they're not coming at the same time, separated by days. Or in our case, by the way, there's even more separation, meaning they're separated by conflicting testimony. Meaning one witness says that mom was not a grusha. Then the two come in and said, no, mom's a grusha. Then the second, in this case, the fourth witness is coming in and agreeing with the first witness and saying, no, mom was not a grusha. And now we're taking one and four and we're putting them together. Even though it's contradicting what two and three said, according to Rabbi Nassan, that's fine. Because it could be mitzvah if you can combine the two together, even though they're not being presented at the same time. Gemara says that's the machlokas, and the Gemara seems to be content with explaining the machlokas in our Mishnah between Rav Elazar against Rabbi Shimon Gamliel as an issue of whether or not we could be mitzaref.
How much time can there be between witness one and witness number
four? According to Rabbi Nassan, it's not clear. The example that's given that he gives is today and tomorrow, but how long could that extend out? I don't know. I'd be guessing. Well, the Gemara had two stages of this discussion. The first thinking that everyone was in agreement, but then in the second stage, the Gemara says, no, that's exactly the machlokas in our Mishnah of whether or not we can combine. Okay. We turn to the next Mishnah, we're in Chav Vav Amud Beis, and the Mishnah is going to be continuing the discussion about the presumption of women in times of danger and crisis. Aisha Shenichmasha, Bidei Ovdei Kochavim, the woman who was taken capture in the hands of non-Jews. So, in other words, she's being held. So the Mishnah here is going to make a very basic distinction in terms of why she's being held. And, based on this distinction that we're going to draw, so under certain circumstances, we'll assume that she was a complicit partner with her captors. In another circumstance, we're going to assume that she was not a complicit partner with her captors. Rashi, but Tosha says it very clearly. Rashi doesn't say it as clearly, but we're not talking about her ability to then go back to her husband, the Kohen. We're talking about her ability to go back to her Yisrael husband. Right? Tosa says on the very bottom, and in just a moment, as we go through the distinction in the Mishnah, you'll see why. The Mishnah says, Al yidei mamon muteres labala. Al yidei nefashos asur labala. If she was taken because it was a monetary issue, meaning her husband owed money to a particular set of non-Jews, okay. And he wasn't paying, and so what they do is they took a collateral. Although in this particular crisis, in this tragedy, the collateral that they took was his wife. But in other words, but they took her for the very specific reason of making sure that they get paid back. So under such circumstances, so the halacha is that when she comes back, there could be a safe assumption, a chazak, if you will, that she was not a complicit partner with her captors. And the reason why, explains Rashi, see the Rashi in the Mishnah, demirasa si lahafsi mamona ve'ina mafkir nosa, because she represents to them, the captors, their satisfaction of the obligation, meaning she's money to them. So now what are they going to do? If they start fooling around with her and they start violating her, so then that's going to compromise their ability to get back the money. So therefore, under these circumstances, the context will tell us that they did not, the assumption is, again, it's an assumption. The assumption is that they did not have relations with her. And she wasn't a willing partner in that act of relations. If, however, it's nefashos, if, let's say, they take her and they over a capital matter. Now, if you take a look at Rashi over here, Rashi says, Shahaisa nidonis lamavis, meaning she herself was being taken because some sort of capital crime that they felt that she was responsible for. So basically, to put it in simple terms, it was like she was on death row. So, and then for some reason, for whatever reason it was, she was released, she was freed. So at that point, you have to assume that she was a complicit partner with her captors. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi explains. So maybe she willingly had relations with one of them. Again, right now for the captors, she's not collateral. She's not being held against any financial obligation. They're just holding her to kill her. So at that point in time, it's hefkerus. And so the default assumption is it says she willingly had relations with them, and therefore she will be prohibited to her husband as she willingly had relations. A couple things. First of all, Tosfos on the bottom over here says, what about women who are modest? What about the tznuos? Right? Remember the Gemara earlier? Very beginning of the Masechta, 3 short weeks ago. The Gemara had a discussion of the women who are tznuos. Would first give up their lives rather than having relations with anyone other than their husband. So Tosfos says, yeah, but over here, you can't assume that. In other words, that's not going to be a safe assumption that the woman who was taken in question is a tznuah. And maybe I can also add to Tosfos that if she's being taken in for a capital crime, that probably doesn't match a model of a woman who's a tznuah. Okay, granted, I'm generalizing, but it could also be that you could throw that into the discussion as well.
And she doesn't declare anything. I mean, if she comes back.
Well, again, self-reporting, like we said throughout the Masechta, self-reporting is not going to help, right? Self-reporting is not going to help a status change. So that's the Mishnah. Now Amar Shmuel, let's go right to the Gemara. Amar Shmuel Bar Rav Yitzchak Amar Rav Lo Shanu Alo Shiyad Yisot Tkifa Al Dikochavim. Aval Yod Av Dikochavim Tkifa Al Atzman Afil Al Yidei Mamon Asu Al Abalam. So Rav Shmuel Bar Rav Yitzchak says in the name of Rav that this halacha that we just saw in the Mishnah, that if she's taken for ransom, meaning it's a financial obligation, and she's only being held against the financial obligation, and the default assumption is that she will keep herself, she will not willingly have relations with her captors. That, says the Gemara, is only going to be true if the general political scene is that the Yad Yisrael Tkifa, that there is, the Jews are autonomous, there's Jewish law, and so therefore the captors are going to be a little bit scared. Meaning, look, they're kidnapping her. I mean, don't get me wrong. They obviously have some degree of courage, but at the same time, however, they're also worried that if they do anything to her, if they harm her, if they do anything to her, so then they're not going to get their money. In other words, the only reason why they're holding her is just simply to get the money, and not going to do anything else to her. However, if the political landscape is such where we are not autonomous, but Yad of Dikochav Tkifa, that we are only sojourners in a non-Jewish political field, and under such circumstances, so we don't get the benefit of assumption that she was not a complicit. She did not have complicit relations with her captors, and the assumption behind this is that since now we have no autonomy, and there's no governance, and they're not afraid of any ramifications. So now we go to a stage of hefkerus, and once we go to a stage of hefkerus, so even if it's over something which is monetary, so then the assumption is going to be that she, in order to save herself and to save her life, she's going to have relations with them, and that's going to be, and she'll do so complicitly. Okay, that's the statement to Rav. Mesiv Rava. And to all this now, we're going to ask a question from a Mishnah in Adios. Now, we're going to look at this Mishnah in Adios 3 different times in the course of the next, 5 or 10 minutes. The Mishnah in Adios describes a similar scenario. It's not exactly the same, but nevertheless, the Mishnah in Adios will seemingly present the problem. Hey, Rav Yossi, HaKohen, Rav Zechariah ben HaKatzav HaBas Yisrael, Shehor Ana BeAshkelon. So the Gemara tells a story, Adios, meaning, right, all the Mishnahs in Adios are there to give actual testimonies of here's what happened, and here's what the rabbi said. Meaning the Mishnahs and Adios are actually episodes, they're incidents. So the following incident about a woman who was taken in Ashkelon, she was Hor Ena. Okay, what does that mean? She was basically taken as a mashkon, as a collateral against a loan. And Virku b'nei mishpachta. She comes from a family of Kohanim. And the members of the family kind of pushed her away. Meaning eventually when she did come back, members of the family said, look, you've You've gone through a status change. Meanwhile, witnesses said that she was not alone with her captors in a room, and she was not subject to being with her captors. And here's how the Chachamim responded. If you're of the belief, if you're going to extend credibility that she was in fact taken capture, so then you're also going to have to believe her that she kept herself pristine. And if you don't believe her that she was taken captive, so then don't believe her about her keeping herself pristine. Basically, to put it in terminology that you and I are more familiar with at the end of the second parak, HaPesha Asur, HaPesha Hitter. Meaning, it's she the one who provided the information that she was taken as collateral, so she herself can now also say that she kept herself pristine. Now, that's the Mishnah Nedios. The Gemara is analyzing. Now, in terms of Ashkelon is a town. At that time, while the Mishnah was being written, Ashkelon was a time where the political scene was, it was not Jewish autonomy, it was non-Jewish autonomy. In fact, if you look at the last Rashi on the page, Rashi writes, Eresh Plishtimi, Va'od Kvar Galu Yisroel. Ashkelon at the time was a Plishtim land. And furthermore, says Rashi, the Jews were exiled. So we're talking about where Jews do not have autonomy. And meanwhile, the Ketani, now that we know what the context was of that Mishnah Nedios, what did the Mishnah say? Hur ana in nichbashalo. The Mishnah Nedios gives a very specific scenario. She was applied as collateral. Look at the first Rashi in Chavzayna Madalif. Rashi writes, Hur ana dimidas, meaning it was done willingly. Now, when Rashi says willingly, I'm not 100% sure who was the one offering her as collateral. Meaning it was the borrowers who were offering as collateral. Harder to imagine, almost impossible to imagine. She herself was offered as collateral. But the idea was that she wasn't taken. Meaning she was given over. So, under those circumstances, what we're going to do, says the Mishnah Nedios, is we're going to question whether or not she was complicit or not complicit. But nechbashalo. But not if she was taken. So if she was taken, Rashi, ena nechletas lahem lo be'inan edim hov al-yidei mamonu. So it sounds like from the Mishnah Nedios that the only reason why we need, so to say, credibility, if we need either witnesses or in the Mishnah Nedios, they didn't have witnesses, but you had the principle of apesha asur or apesha iter, which is, as we pointed out a number of times, that is credibility. But that's only because she was handed over willingly. But in a scenario where she was taken, and it's a monetary obligation, even though the context, the political scene is that we are not autonomous, and that we are living by the non-Jews, it sounds like from the Mishnah Nedios, she has a presumption of being Kshera. And we don't assume that she had relations with her captors. So the Gemara to that. Okay, so basically, what did we just do? We learned the Mishnah Nedios. We made a general assumption of what the political scene was in Ashkelon, and we made a diuk in the Mishnah Nedios because the Mishnah is talking about her being willingly handed over, as opposed to what we're describing, which is she was taken against her will. So the Gemara says, "Lo." The diuk is not correct. The Gemara says that the same halachic conclusion would be even if she were taken. Now remember, it's a Mishnah Nedios. Mishnah Nedios is not telling us what theoretical halacha is. The Mishnah Nedios is telling us this is what actually happened. So you can't make diukim in the Mishnah Nedios. You can't say, oh, you see what the Mishnah Nedios is? Mishnah Nedios is talking about that case. No, the reason why it's talking about that case is because that case actually happened. So the Gemara says, so don't make a diuk in the Mishnah Nedios. So, here we go now, round two. Okay, so once again, we're going to do the same thing. Once again, we're going to quote the Mishnah Nedios, compare it against our Mishnah, but it's basically going to come out to the same point. We learned the Mishnah Nedios. Again, the Gemara just quoted the entire Mishnah Nedios once again, and then the Gemara makes the same observation, that Ashkelon, she was taken for monetary reasons as a collateral against the note, and the reason why she comes back with and a presumption of being sheira is because there was actual testimony. So, but if there was no testimony about her, so then she is not afforded a status of kashrus, which fits exactly what Rav said. That Rav was of the opinion that if the political climate is that we are not autonomous, she doesn't come back with a state of kashrus. The Gemara says, "Lav lo shna harana v'lo shna nichbasha lo harana." I'm sorry. V'lo shna nichbasha lo harana shani. So the Gemara says that it's not necessarily a proof, because what we could just simply argue is that the case in Adios is talking about where she was willingly given over. And maybe that's why it's different over there. Mashe Inkin, we're talking about in our case, Nichbasha. So the Gemara wanted to use the Mishnah in Adios as a proof, but the Gemara just deflected and said the Mishnah in Adios is not necessarily a proof, because it's talking about where she was willingly given over. The Gemara then does it a third time, and all we're going to do now is we're just going to compare our Mishnah to the Mishnah in Adios. Our Mishnah says that if she was taken for monetary concern or for monetary reasons, so therefore we don't assume that she was violated. And then the Gemara over here goes to the Mishnah in Adios, although at this point in time, you know the Mishnah in Adios. Now, the reason why she was taken in Ashkelon is because of money. And the reason why she comes back with a status of kashrus is because there was actual testimony. But if there was no testimony about her, then she's going to be not presumed to be kosher. And meanwhile, our Mishnah says that even without Eidus, we assume that she's kosher. And to which the Gemara says, the difference is as follows. The different political climates. If we're talking about Ashkelon, and it's in a non-Jewish political climate, so then, unless you have Edom, you can't assume that she's kosher. If, however, our Mishnah Ksuvos is talking about where the political climate was, that we, the Jewish people, were autonomous, and the woman was taken, so then her captors are going to be afraid of the legal system. Again, afraid meaning, remember, in the context where they took her, but afraid of violating her if it's a monetary issue. And therefore, our Mishnah says that you don't need testimony in order to give her a status of remaining kosher. Okay, Adkan, that's the... We did it three different ways, but basically, how do you see our Mishnah? How do you see the Mishnah in Adios? How do you compare the two? Okay. Continuing in the Gemara. Ayidei Nefashos Asura. Okay, if she's taken for nefashos, so then she's going to be prohibited. Our Mishnah said that a woman who was taken because of some sort of judgment against her, capital crime against her, so it's hefkeres, and therefore you have to be concerned over the fact that she will willingly be with her captors, kind of to save herself, etc., etc. I hesitated from making this point back in the Mishnah, but I'll just make it quickly right now. Meaning, it does force us to think about what is the definition of ones, what's the definition of ratzon. Meaning, ones means something that was totally against her will. Ratzon means that she was totally complicit, and she was totally willing. But there's obviously, in other words, those are the two extremes, and those are too easy to categorize. But what if we're somewhere in the middle? Like, for example... Right, I believe this week we're going to be reading the Megillah. Okay, that's my report. Hopefully, I'm reporting correctly. So, like Esther, for example. So, Esther, for example, right at one of the turning points in the Megillah. So she turns to Mordechai. Mordechai says, "Okay, now you got to be with the king, and you got to be with the king willingly to save the Jewish people." So, right, the Gemara Megillah describing, explaining the pasuk Asher Avadati Avadati, and what does Esther say to Mordechai? Yeah, but that's it then. In other words, once I'm willing with Achashverosh, so then I'm going to be prohibited to you. Kasher Avadati Avadati, the Gemara Megillah explains. So over there, I mean, again, that it, this is, now we're somewhere in the middle. Meaning, on one hand, she is doing it willingly with Achashverosh, on the other hand, for the reason of saving the Jewish people. Meaning, can't you make an argument that, yeah, that's correct, right. In other words, willing meaning, yeah, the act itself is willing, but if she doesn't do it, think of the ramifications of what she doesn't do, or what happens if she doesn't do it. So this is one of those. It's right, one of those middle categories. Now,
she's saving herself. She's saving the whole Jewish
people. She's saving the whole Jewish people in doing so. So right, is that ones or is that ratzon? Again, the Gemara Megillah says that's clearly ones. Meaning, sorry, Let me restate that incorrectly. Right. Check that last statement I said. The Gemara in Megillah says that that is a case of Ratzon. But again, though, it really forces us to think of what the definition is of Onus and Ratzon. Here also, where it's somewhat comparable, where she's being held, it's a capital offense, that she's basically sitting somewhere in death row, and again, she's going to be with one of her captors, maybe with the hope of she'll, you know, it'll save her. Is that Onus or is that Ratzon? And again, the assumption we're making over here is it's Ratzon. So it really forces us, I'm not saying anything definitive. I'm just talking out loud, I'm thinking out loud. It just forces us to really think of what the definition of Onus and Ratzon is in these contexts. So just meaning examples. What would be examples of a woman being taken for a capital crime? So the Gemara is going to give a couple of examples. Rashi is going to explain that they're actually arguing. Nishe ganve. Wives of robbers. Wives of robbers, Rashi. Sheba'aleim nitlin. V'derech ha'malkos lafkir beitamu nisheim. Their husbands were hung. I'm always confused. Hanged, hung. I know when talking about clothing, it's one way. And people, it's another way. I that much I know. Which one you think it is?
Hanged.
Okay. I should know this, by the way. In other words, but in just, you know, on the Purim, we're going to, right, for most famous hanged person, coming up in just a short couple days from now. Anyway, so the husbands were hanged, and Rashi describes that what happens. So once the husbands get hanged, so then wives are totally mufkar, meaning they are, the government then feels like, and anyone who wants can come in and can take the wives in. So therefore, they're totally open to.
How can it be forbidden to their husband if they were hanged already?
Right, that's more than a reasonable question. Meaning, I think what the Gemara is doing is just giving us an example of what is the circumstance in which the woman is taken. Meaning, unlike you see Rashi in the Mishnah. Is describing where they themselves are being judged for capital crime. But over here, the Gemara is just giving us examples and scenarios in which, like, the non-Jews are taking her and with no reservation whatsoever, and they're going to be comfortable, unfortunately, to do whatever they want. Another Gemara goes on, another example, Levi Amar Kigon Ishtosha Ben Dunai. An example of that would be the wife of Ben Dunai. Take a look at Rashi, Rotzeach Haya. So first of all, Rashi gives us some good information. First of all, he was a murderer, and secondly, his name was Elazar. Okay. Rashi knows that because this is also referenced in the Gemara Sota at the end of the Masechta. And the way Rashi understands the Gemara over here is that he's arguing with Rav. Can I give you just a good trick in Gemara? It's not a trick. But it's just good to know in Gemara. How did Rashi know that? How did Rashi know that the second opinion was arguing the first opinion? So it's just one of those classic rules in Gemara that you get sensitive to when you see more and more Gemara. And that is that if you look at the way the Gemara presents the two opinions, first the Gemara says, I'm a Rav Kigon. Right? Rav says the following. And then, what's the next line of the Gemara? Levi Amar. And Levi says, when you see the name being placed before the word Amar, it means that you say this, but Levi says this, meaning by putting the name first. So it means by that little subtle switching of the words, so you know that Levi is arguing on the previous position. And the way Rashi understands it, what Levi's saying is no. It's not enough for the husbands to be robbers and bandits and to be charged and tried on that. That doesn't mean that the non-Jewish government is going to do whatever they please with the wives. It has to be a much more heinous crime that's done on the part of the husband in order for the authorities to declare the wives to be hefka. So, Kagon Isha ben Dunai. Amechizke v'hu shenigmar dino lahariga v'rav Yochanan amar afa pisho nigmar dinan lahariga. So the Gemara says, is it before Gemar Din, is it after Gemar Din? So the Gemara brings down a machlokas between Rechizkiah and Rav Yochanan, whether it has to be, this is only true after Gemar Din or even before Gemar Din as well. Rav Yochanan's position is usually the accepted one. I see the Rambam over here goes like Rav Yochanan. So that means that if the husband is being charged on a capital crime, and even though it was, it's on death row, but at that point in time, the wives are considered mufkaris there. they lose their status of being kshera. Okay, up to the next Mishnah, and the topic is not going to change. It's still going to be a dreadful topic. And that is more discussions of the status of women. Here, however, we're moving to Kohanim and to an Eishes Kohen. Now, again, the halacha is that the Eishes Kohen is going to be prohibited to her husband, even if, God forbid, she was violated. Nevertheless, she's going to be prohibited. We discussed this at length in Yevamos in terms of the nature of this halacha. She is, and I know it's hard to hear, it's hard to digest, but it's just gzeiros hakasuv that. But the way we described it back in Yevamos is that she has a zona status. We're not saying she's a zona. She was violated; it's against her will. But she has a zona status, and therefore she's prohibited to her husband, even if she was even if it was against her will.
What happens to her ketubah?
No, in other words, she'll still get the ksuva. But in other words, she'll be prohibited to her husband. Ir shekivshua charkom shel kahanos. So you have a city over here that was captured. And charkom, Rashi says, that's a siege. The word charkom is described in the Torah, in the Rashi quotes Targum, right? Matsur. So in other words, you had a non-Jewish siege against the city. Kol kahanos shenimtsu besocha psula. Every kahana, right? I know that doesn't translate well in English. But Eishes Kohen, any wife of a Kohen is presumed to have been violated. Now here we're not describing, unlike the previous Mishnah, where there the concern was her having a complicit relations with her captor. Here in this Mishnah, we're talking about she was being violated. And again, in the case of Eishes Kohen, she will be prohibited to her husband. So here she kavshu karchom shakana shenimtsa besocha psulos. So I'm sorry. So all the Eishes Kohens in that city are going to be disqualified. However, if there's Eidos that says that she was not violated, so the Eidos can uphold her status. And here the Chachamim were Mekel. Now this is not the first time we've seen a Kula by the Chachamim. Remember, Shvuya. We also described earlier how when a woman is taken captive, so they're also. Self-reporting for her is not going to help her. But if you have testimony about her, even if that testimony is provided by one, and even if the one is someone who cannot normally testify, i.e. a woman or a shivcha, so then she will maintain her status here as well. In the scenario where the city was surrounded and sieged by non-Jews, so she will, if you have Eidos that says that she is that she has not been violated, so the Eidos works, and even if it's Eved, Shivcha, even if it's one. But the Mishnah says, as if we didn't know this at this point in time, but Mishnah just, I guess it's being clear, but self-reporting is not going to help her. She needs someone to corroborate her story that she was in fact not violated. Uriminu. The Gemara over here is bothered by a Mishnah in Avodah Zarah. So I'll say that we saw the Mishnah together in Avodah Zarah. We get to see it now again. The Mishnah in Avodah Zarah describes the following. Balasha Shabalair. So the Mishnah is describing basically the same thing. The word Balasha over here, Rashi says, it's an army. Their main purpose over here is to plunder. Right? Rashi describes in the Gemara. First Rashi in the Gemara. Chayel al Shem Shemechapsin Kolat Matmunim. Okay, they're interested right now in looting the entire city. So they're going everywhere. So Bishar Shalom. So in a time of peace, I mean, obviously nothing's funny in these circumstances, but just I'm pointing to the irony of, you know, here you have a marauding army, and you know, it's generally speaking, it's peaceful. Everything is pleasant except for the fact that right now there's an army running through town and looting. Okay, so all right. I'm just acknowledging. I understand it's ironic. So Bishar Shalom Chavias Pesuchas Asuras Tumas Mutaris. Now, the Mishnayos and Avodah Zarah is really focusing on one aspect, and that's wine. We know the halacha is that wine that's handled by a non-Jew has a status of Stam Yenam and is prohibited. So the Mishnah of Avodah Zarah says, what's our assumptions? Meaning, we didn't see any of the wine getting handled, and we know that non-Jews ran rampant through the city. So what do we assume? So the Mishnah says, open barrels are subject to the Isser of Stam Yenam. Closed barrels are protected. Meaning, the default assumption is going to be the non-Jews didn't open up the barrel. B'shamachama, however, if it's a time of war, so that means now that there's more frenzy, there's more panic, there's just more chaos. So under those circumstances, elu ve'elu mutaros lefi she'ein panai lanasech. So the Mishnah says, with more chaos, actually, it actually is better for the wine. Obviously, for pretty much every other aspect, it's worse because it's shas mechama. But at least from the one limited perspective of the wine, it's better because ein lan panai, meaning they're not going to be comfortable sitting there, hanging around, opening a barrel, or looking or putting their hands into an already open barrel, and so therefore all barrels are going to be safe, with the presumption that the non-Jew didn't handle it. So the Gemara is bothered. How could it be that our Mishnah over here describes where they have an army coming through town, and all women are going to be violated, meaning they're going to stop and take their time to violate the women, but the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah describes how they're not going to stop and take the time and start handling wine? So the Gemara says, you got to understand Yetzer Hara. When it comes to the violation of women, so that's a Yetzer Hara, and that Yetzer Hara is unbelievably strong. Rashi writes, the takif lehu yitzrayhu. The Yetzer Hara is unbelievably strong. But for wine, meaning right now we're marauding, we're, you know, it's chaos, it's war, right? They're not going to make time for that, for wine. Rabbi Yitzchak bar Elazar mishmei dechizki amar kan b'chalkom shalos amachos kan b'chalkom shalmachos acheres. Another possible distinction, says the Gemara, is the following: when we're talking about sieging armies, so are we talking about are they laying a siege in their own town, meaning within their own municipality? Or are they visiting from somewhere else? And he goes on to explain what's the difference. The Gemara doesn't explain the difference. We're going to have to explain the difference, right? Rashi writes, "Karkam shalos amachus eino rotzel ashchitzes bnei ir ukishik kovish ir hasamach lemem shalto shomer ziv lo lamas oved." So I'm sorry, shomra. So vihilo lamas oved. So if it's a neighboring town that they're marauding, so basically that means then that they're going to be a little bit more protective of the population, the people they're in. That's why the women are going to be safe and secure. Masha ain't kain, if we're talking about where they're coming in from outside, and they really do not care about the population whatsoever, so then we're going to have to suspect and be concerned that the women were taken and violated, and maybe that's another way to outline the distinction between the two. Let's just finish up with the following. So the Gemara says, So the Gemara says, even if it's a local army coming into town, aren't there going to be some soldiers who are going to have the Yetzer Hara get the best of them, run into the town and start violating women? So the Gemara says no. The local army who is sieging around the city, so they're going to make sure, again, it's a local army, and even though obviously they're laying a siege, but they are interested in protecting the people of that city, and so they're laying a guard around the city. So the Gemara says, "Yevshad dolonema porta." So the Gemara says, "Okay, that's nice, but you don't think one of the guards is going to take a nap?" Amar Rabbi Levi, "Kigon demahadolei lamasa shushilta v'kalba v'gavza v'avza." So the Gemara says it's serious guarding. Gemara describes over here where dogs, geese, sticks and stones, spikes, or laid all around the city in order to make sure that no one's going to be going through. And Rashi says that, and if anyone does try, their guards, their geese, right, so far I don't really fully understand the geese, but their dogs, and the dogs are going to bark, and basically it's a very strong perimeter set around the city to make sure that, yes, it's true, there's a siege being laid by the non-Jews, but at the same time, it's a local army, and therefore they are going to be protective of the people they're in. Amar Rabbi Abba Zavta Pligi Bar Rav Yehuda Nisi Avar Rabban Echad Amar Kam Becharkum Shalos Amachos Kam Becharkum Shalmachos Echares V'lo Kashilei V'lo Midi. One version is that the distinction that we made between a local army versus an outside army, that's the distinction, and you could stop at that point in time. Meaning you don't need to come on to guards, perimeters, dogs, geese, meaning just that distinction by itself is enough. V'chad kashle kohani, and the other Amora was bothered, yeah, even if it's a local army, they're not going to take advantage of the opportunity. And they basically said that like we said a moment ago, where geese and dogs and sticks and stones and spikes were laid around the city in order to create a secure perimeter around the city to make sure that none of the members of the army are going to go into the city and attack within the city. Okay, we finished up the Gemara's discussion of what it takes in order to maintain the status of a Kohen. Eidus, one aid going to be enough. The big issue of whether or not we can combine two witnesses who are testifying not at the same time, not together. We then go on to discuss women taken into captivity. Do we assume that she is pristine? Do we assume that she is complicit with her captors? The Gemara drew a distinction there. And we're now approaching the end of the second parakeet. We started the Mishnah about an army laying siege, and the Gemara's distinction between a local army versus an outside army, and whether or not the women in that army are assumed to have been violated or not violated. We're going to continue with this discussion tomorrow.